Welcome to the Jacob's Well podcast. These messages are intended to feed you some great stuff that you can really dig your teeth into all week and beyond. That's why you can find it anytime, along with other great resources and ways to keep the conversation going at jacobs-well.net/leftovers. Enjoy the message.
Well, good morning, Jacob's Well. You can find a seat, and thank you for being with us this morning. And a happy Mother's Day to those of you. So Mother's Day is one of these complicated holidays, but you know, some of us are happy to be mothers. Some of us maybe aren't happy to be a mother this morning. Some of us had wonderful experiences with our mothers, and some of us didn't, and some of us would like to be mothers and we're not, and it's all kind of there, but I think we can all agree that, like, mothers are a good thing. And we all at least have our existence to thank to a mother someplace. So those of you, you know, if this is a limelight day for you, enjoy it. I know that you've earned at least that much. So thank you so much. This is our fifth week and our last week of our series of Won't You Be My Neighbor? And you know, it's important. We at Jacob's Well, one of our foundational ideas that we've actually been weaving into our life for some years, but we've been talking a lot about it just recently, is rope. And you see these ropes up here, and some of you like didn't even notice them, or maybe you wonder why they're there, but there are reminders. In fact, you're always welcome to come up here if something happened in your life to weave a couple together or put a knot in it just as a little reminder for yourself, or to look over there and say, that knot up there, that was mine. But the whole idea is that life is really strong and life is vibrant when we weave ourselves together with God in community. I mean, there's really no other choice. We either weave ourselves together with God, who gives us that breadth of understanding and experience about what the world is all about, unlike we can ever quite fathom or handle ourselves with our own limited ability to see and understand and perceive and to know the future and to be thinking so long term. But then also with others. With God, you know, life isn't about being alone. God created us to be in community, to be neighbors with one another. And neighbors doesn't just mean the person down the block or just other people. It means everything. It includes creation, includes the galaxies. I mean, it's everything. God made us a whole together, and we play our part that way. So we've been talking about neighbors and how to be neighbors. We've talked about some of the hard parts, the challenging parts. We've talked about some of the promises. Today we want to talk about a little different aspect of neighbors, and it's one that may not pop in your head right away when you think about it, but it basically boils down to this very simple idea, and that is we could say we want to be good neighbors. We want to break down all the barriers in our community, and I'm going to, you know, that's my intention, that's what I'm going to try to do, but all of your intentions could, like, just be wiped out totally because of things about your physical environment that keep us from being neighbors. You know, you say, I want to know the person who's in the next block west of me, but unfortunately there's a freeway that runs between you and the block west of you. I mean, there's all kinds of things in our world that separate us from one another, and we sometimes forget that our intention and our desire to be community, our desire to be good neighbors, gets wiped out by the physical environment around us, the built environment around us. God cares about that. And this is another problem, then, maybe one of the reasons we don't think about this. You know, when we think about God and what God loves and what God's at work in, we think of people, we think of nature, and then kind of it stops there. But what about the built environment? What about all the stuff we make? I mean, God loves that too. In fact, there's a lot of stuff in the Bible that talks about it. If you look at your outlines on the back of your Sunday paper, you're going to find a Bible verse there. It says, this is God speaking to the prophet Jeremiah hundreds and hundreds of years before the time of Jesus. God says, but seek the welfare of the city. Seek the welfare of the city, big or small, doesn't matter. The city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf. And this is the key part. For in its welfare, you will find your welfare. We're inseparable from the physical world and what we've developed and the city that we build around ourselves. And so we need to be careful for that. And so the fill-in there is simply this. God cares about people. We sure hope that's true. We know that's true. Okay, that's pretty obvious. God cares about nature. Yep. God also cares about the built environment. So we're going to talk about that. We're not going to talk about the built environment for its own sake, but because it's intrinsic. Until we start understanding how we can be involved and how we can deal with and promote a healthy built environment around us, our desire to be good neighbors is really going to be thwarted by us. We've got a guest with us today. Sarah Joy Prope is here someplace. There she is. Come on down, Sarah. Sarah Joy. And Sarah Joy is both an expert and a strong advocate on the built environment. And then also we have Amanda Meyer, whose middle name is also Joy, which is coincidence. But Amanda is my daughter, yes. She also is doing her PhD at the U right now in urban ecology, which is dealing with a lot of these questions from, more from the environment perspective, not so much from the structural, the architectural or kind of perspective. Right. I'm probably not doing either of them justice. But anyway, so what you are welcome to do is we're going to be talking and discussing some things, but we really like your questions and your input as well. So my text number you can text in questions is up there at the top of the screen. It'll stay up there through most of the stuff. It's also on the top of your Sunday paper up on the header up here. You got that? So feel free to do that. If you don't want to text or don't like to text, you just want to tear off a piece of your Sunday paper and run it down here, you can do that. In fact, like if you raise your hand, we'll first ask you if you need to go to the bathroom, and then after that, we'll ask what your question is. No, we won't heckle you. So you're welcome to do that any way you want. So Sarah Joy, thank you for being here, first of all.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. You're doing some amazing work in this, but before we jump into anything else, so why the built environment? What about this got you so interested, and what does this all mean to you? Small questions.
Well, I had a few clues starting out as a little girl. I wasn't picking up on them yet, but I was arranging my dollhouses in particular orders rather than actually playing with the dolls. And I played a lot of SimCity growing up. I don't know if y'all are familiar with that computer game. You get to planning school, and you realize like everybody else was playing SimCity too, so you kind of find your tribe. So I went and did a degree in English literature because I love stories. And it was through that process, actually, that I found urban planning and discovered kind of the built environment, because I started reading stories in light of the setting and realizing that a lot of times the setting affects characters and the way stories develop. And I thought that that was just incredibly fascinating. And so I started reading books. Jane Jacobs, she's a great urbanist. She wrote The Death and Life of Great American Cities. You read that book and you're like, wow, the way that our cities are designed and developed really does affect the way people's stories play out. So that's kind of the process of how I got into it. So then I went on and did a master's degree in urban planning and have just kind of been a nerd about it ever since.
That's great. Yeah. And you work a lot with churches around this as well.
I do. So that's another fascinating thing for me. As I was in planning school and I work full-time in real estate development right now, I just started asking, where's the church in this conversation? So often I don't see the church at the table in understanding the built environment. We're very good at talking about, caring for people's souls and their spirituality, but we're not very good about necessarily thinking how that plays out in the physical world. And so I thought, I think a lot of it is just the churches aren't educated in this component. And so it would be a great opportunity to get out and educate people and say, hey, this actually really does affect your story. And so that's what I've been doing with, I started Proximity Project. It's an initiative here in the Twin Cities. And it's a way for me to have these conversations with churches and really show that, God loves the world, and loving the world includes streets and curbs and sidewalks and things like that that we often take for granted.
Right. And I think for a lot of churches that own property, they'd say, well, what do we, churches tend to be geographically pretty carefully placed, so prominent. They have property and they can contribute to the built environment. We don't have that. We don't own property. So the thing that doesn't let us off the hook, that means it drives to where the real church is, and that's us. Wherever we live, wherever we work, where we are, that is where Jacob's Well is. So what we're talking about today is something that could transform a lot of territory, and that's kind of cool.
Definitely. And I think, too, what's interesting about Jacob's Well, and a lot of churches are doing this, is it's not a typical church space. So you're utilizing a space that would otherwise be vacant on a Sunday. And so I think that's also a great use of community resources. And I've been encouraging churches who own their own space to think about what are ways that we could open up our space the other 5-6 days of the week, to the community so that it doesn't sit vacant. So just thinking creatively about those things.
Right, so let me ask you, so built environment, for a lot of people that might be a brand new term. When we're talking about built environment,
right,
what is that? And this is on your Sunday papers, by the way, too.
So very basic. I think people think it's a lot more complicated than it is. It is literally just the streets, the sidewalks, parks, gardens, things that are modified by humankind here. And so it's, I think a lot of times people take it, as I said, take it for granted because you live in it. So it's kind of like a fish swimming in water, right? You don't actively think about it, but yet it's there and it's affecting your everyday life in ways that you're probably very unaware of, but very significant ways.
In reality, I suppose there's very little space that isn't built anymore.
Right.
I mean, even what stuff that we call wilderness has been modified by
exactly.
people.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. So I was just saying, a material and spatial cultural product of human labor, human-made surroundings that provide the setting for human activity.
Right.
You have a new way of saying that, that encompasses places and spaces created or modified by people. So you talk about spaces and you talk about places. I always thought those were the same thing, so spelled differently.
Okay.
Tell me, what's the difference between space and a place?
Could I ask Catherine to go to slide number one of mine? Because I like to use this as an example.
That's good.
Okay. So I like people to look at this picture. The top two pictures are obviously Target, right? But can you tell me where you are besides being at Target? Anyone? A parking lot, right?
Roseville.
But can you tell me Roseville, possibly, right? You can't necessarily tell me where you are, correct? Where is the bottom picture? Who can tell me where that is? It's actually not Target Field. I didn't mean to do this to be tricky. It's actually Wrigley Field, and you might not be able to tell that because it's a little further away. But the reason I like to do this is I like to get people thinking about the fact that, you know, and this is not a knock against Target. They employ a lot of my friends. They're a great corporation here in the Twin Cities.
You do have a red sweater on.
Yeah, it's probably from Target. But anyways, but what it's doing is showing you that the kind of the difference between a space and a place. So the big box chain stores are more, tend to be on this level of a space, right? There's not necessarily active stories that are happening in these places. They're not necessarily creating kind of these cultural identities or like shared memories. When you go to Target, you're not sharing memories with people who are shopping at Target with you, probably. You know, you might sometimes, but on the whole, it's not very common. But a place like Wrigley Field, right, it has a lot of history. There's a lot of shared story. There's a lot of cultural meaning in that place. And so that's really kind of that transition from space to place. And it's not a black and white definition. You know, it's on a spectrum. There's definitely places that can be... because I wouldn't say that there's no stories happening at Target, right? There are some stories happening there, but not kind of that iconic cultural story that you have in some of these other places.
We were talking about that earlier, then I was thinking that of my real significant memories that I have that I hold on to, almost all of them have a place connected to it. And I, you know, this is maybe a little bit of a blunt statement, but I can't think of any of them being at a strip mall.
Right.
You know?
Likely not.
Yeah, they weren't. If they are, I remember maybe it was a strip mall and that's where the connection to that ends. But, you know, the place is like by a lake or at the park or around the fireplace at home or, you know, place things like that seem to be really important. And so how important is then to this idea of place? I mean, so you made a distinction there between space and place, but why is that important? And that's, by the way, that's the fill in there if you miss it. Spaces are places that have a story. Mm-hmm. And stories transform places into spaces for us. But.
Right. Well, I think, I mean, as human beings, God created us to live out a story, right? And for me, I think what's really important, what I see, if you see in the Bible, you have this story of Adam and the fall, and then you have the retelling of that story with the coming of Jesus and redemption. And so there's this retelling that has to happen. And in order to retell a story and to redeem a story, you have to be able to remember. And so part of that is a place invokes memory, right? It enables us to remember stories, to remember monumental markers in our lives. And even in the Old Testament, as Israel's wandering through the wilderness, you know, God calls them to build cairns, to build places that are significant, that say, you can physically point to this and tell future generations of my faithfulness. And so I think that those physical markers are really important. And so it's really important to build places that evoke memory that can be those physical markers, as you were saying, you know, in your life, some of your most poignant memories come from particular places and things that you maybe learned or interactions that you had with your community or your family.
Right. And I think, you know, one could get too black and white about this. And like I think you said, this is a spectrum of how it happens. But, you know, to be a little bit black and white about it, I would almost say that spaces are places that have a soul. I mean, and yeah, I realize that's judgmental. All right. So, you know, don't point at, oh, that place is soulless. For some person, maybe it is. But I think when we start creating we start creating geography around ourselves without really taking seriously what the story is and what the character of the place and the people is and what is needed there, we tend to build generic, innocuous things that we have transactions with but not relationships.
Right.
And it tends to not be really transformative space. Mm-hmm. And that's a challenge to us. And I think, you know, with a booming economy, with, you know, American exceptionalism, you know, we just go. Let's just go build. Let's, you know, create the economy, create whatever. And again, I don't want to be too black and white on that, but at the same time, I think we can feel the distinction that it's easy to just build and sometimes not take the time to think about, you know, well, who's here and what is the role that this has to play?
Definitely. And I would say a lot of that, too, that what you see of the way things are built today is a function of modern-day zoning. Early 1920s or so, cities were given the right to do zoning. And so what that did is, at the time, it was seen hopeful because, you know, you might have a glue factory next to an elementary school, right? And so it was done as to separate these uses for safety and health reasons. And so that was a very good reason for zoning. But at the same time, it kind of took it to a different level. And now zoning codes enforce things like setbacks from the street. So how far your house or your business has to be away from the street. And it's and lots of times there's quite a big setback. And it's actually shown that buildings that come up along the sidewalk and interact with the street actually provide much more community life and public interaction. And there also, you know, affects things like parking count. You have to have a certain number of parking spots with a certain particular type of business that gets built. So then you have these large parking lots that get developed that, you know, actually sit empty for a majority of the week and things like that. And so I think we don't think about how zoning has really affected our lives, but it has. And in a turn, it's also made walking a lot less plausible in our communities. And I think that that's really important to be aware of, is that, you know, God created us to walk. And it's when
we have 2 feet, one for the gas and one.
Whoa.
What is it? Why is the second one for again?
You bought it, hook, line, and sinker. you know, so God created us to walk. And really, when we're out walking, that opens up the space for us to run into neighbors and to rub elbows with people we may not necessarily normally rub elbows with. There's a lot of people that talk about that's the way that civic virtue is actually created in our society, is being in public space with people who are not like you and maneuvering that and figuring that out. And even for our children, there's been a lot of articles recently about parents being seen as neglectful because they let their children go outside and go to the corner store by themselves. You know, whereas that used to be how things were done. And that was what allowed children to learn responsibility and to interact with the neighbors. And that, you know, enabled the grandma down the street to kind of have her eyes on the neighborhood and making sure everybody was staying in order, you know. And we don't have that anymore, so.
Right, right. So, like, you know, zoning, I don't think, was a conspiracy. It was done for good reasons. But then maybe with the advent of the car, we realize, well, we can really separate these things because people have cars that can drive to them. And now it's gotten to the point where, you know, shopping or, you know, hardware stuff or, you know, everything can, it doesn't need to be close. And so it not only accommodates cars, but it relies on transportation. There's a guy, kind of a futurist that I've followed for a long time named Len Sweet. And I remember talking to him, it was quite a while ago, and he said, and again, this is going to sound judgmental about suburbs, but he said suburbs are going to be the ghetto of the future because they were designed for cars, not people.
Right.
And I think you see a lot of suburbs trying to do that. You know, St. Louis Park is building a downtown. Bloomington is trying to build a downtown. They're trying to say, we need to be a center, not just a periphery that relies on a car to go to something, go someplace else. But.
Right. And I think it's really important to think about social equality and those components too, because as the suburbs, you know, they say, yes, are becoming more ghettoized or whatever.
it's so ghetto.
Sounds really weird to say. But anyways, you know, so what's happening is property values in the city are going up, right? And the more affluent are actually moving back to the city, and then the people who were normally in the city who maybe lower income are being forced out to the suburbs. Well, it's kind of a double whammy, because in the suburbs you have to have a car really to get places, and so because there's just not the density for public transit options like there are in the city. And so you think about it too, I mean, while your cost of living may be cheaper, your transportation costs go up significantly. They say on average it's about $10,000 a year to own a car. And so I think that that's something to think about too. You know, in planning, it's been kind of a detriment of, we've thought a lot about affordability in terms of housing only, and we've not factored in the transportation costs. And so you may live further away and it's more affordable, but you're paying more money for transportation. And so the conversation has been changing more recently to factor in both components. And so I think it's important to think about those things.
Amanda, is there anything there that you think we should be...
Yeah, so I have one question to start with, and we can continue on from that. I have a question about detrimental development in the neighborhood. So this person wants to know, there's a big apartment complex going in their neighborhood, and they're worried about the traffic and the extra people coming in when it opens. And so how do you work with negative development or prevent negative development in your own neighborhood?
Mm-hmm. Well, I always say, go to the neighborhood association meetings early and be an active participant when there's good things happening and when there's bad things happening. Because if you show up only when it's bad, you don't have a history there. You don't have a standing in the neighborhood association to really speak into it, is my opinion. Because I think, you know, we have a tendency to, when something negative starts happening, then that's when we go in angry and we say, we don't want this, you know. So I think being an active participant early is really, really helpful. And I think when you have that standing and when you understand how design works, and if you're active in those meetings, you can speak to developments. Developers do listen, and it's interesting. I mean, I work for a developer right now, and one of the things is we need a neighborhood support letter, really, when we go present our development to City Council. And City Council takes it very seriously. If you don't have that neighborhood support letter, your development is definitely going to get more stringent review and more questions asked about it. So I think, you know, being a participant in those conversations is really important. And, you know, I think as far as traffic and some of those concerns, those always come up. Parking is always an issue, because, yes, we are a car-oriented society in many ways, but yet development is happening that's trying to transition us to a more walkable community. And I think one of the fun ways to engage in some of these conversations yourself is to do more of what we're calling tactical urbanism. So this is the idea that you as neighborhood residents can do things to like test out development of whether or not it's good or bad, of maybe taking a street and narrowing it and doing some more bike lanes or adding in a parklet. We talked about that. Or, you know, putting sidewalk cafes in. And it's a way to do it as an iterative process. So you might go out for a Saturday afternoon with some friends and kind of engage in some tactical urbanism idea and see how the community takes to it. There's so many cities that have shown that, you know, there's these fears of increased traffic. Well, then they'll do a day trial of like, okay, if we change the traffic pattern, will this actually change the traffic and be increased? A lot of times they find that it doesn't. So engaging in some of those tactical processes of figuring out what could and couldn't work is a fun way. I think it's fun. I don't know. To go out and paint temporary bike lanes per day.
Yeah, I don't know if we're going to have time to get into the parklet thing, but it's really caught my imagination. So if we don't, I'll follow it up with some Facebook stuff, and I'd love some people to like think about creating a parklet or two for maybe late summer or this fall with me, but I'll just put that on hold.
I have another question about the walkable communities. And so you were talking about zoning laws from way back when, separating commercial and residential and industrial development. So then now that the idea of walkable communities and getting away from the car has become, it has come into vogue, how has Minneapolis encouraged walkable communities? And then also, when you have something like commercial with residential and then you wind up with busy streets, how can you create those same gathering places and safe spots for people?
Mm-hmm. So one thing that's really interesting, Minneapolis actually has mostly parking maximums now. They used to have parking minimums in their zoning code. And so a maximum means actually you have to go in and apply for a variance or a conditional use permit to increase the amount of parking associated with your business, which is very backwards from how it used to be. And it's funny, we're in a tricky place in the market because we're really excited about that. We appreciate that. Traditional investors in development projects still don't buy into it. And so when they're reviewing, going through due diligence with a developer, they're saying, we want more parking because the market shows that we need X amount of parking. And if you don't have that much parking, you're going to, you know, not get business. And so developers are kind of caught in this tricky place of traditional investors are still back here. The market, you know, walkability, the city's kind of up here pushing this, and we're kind of playing that middle ground of trying to figure out the sweet spot until traditional investors can get more on board with it. So I think proving that that works in the market is so important. And then, will you repeat the second question again for me?
Yeah, I was curious about gathering spaces in like busy areas.
You know, I think that not every area is going to have a gathering space. I think that there are, for example, Snelling and University, that's a major commercial corridor, and that is not going to change. But at the same time, a couple blocks off of that, there are parks and things like that. And so I think that, you know, there are some areas that I feel like they're not malleable to that, and that's okay, because you actually can't have parks on every corner, and that actually, if you do too much of that, you actually end up, it becomes a deterrence from people gathering because, right, there's so many places and not a concentrated space. And so I think that, again, finding that balance between those.
I want to just take a little shift and talk about the whole concept of neighborliness. And because I think if you think about being neighborly, maybe it helps you decide, like, well, what do we want to develop? How do we want the built environment to match? And Scott, can I make you come down here? This is Scott Schluter, everybody. Yay, Scott! And Amanda, could you hand your mic on over to Sarah Joy? Or give it, all right, Scott. Have a seat. So Scott took our message the other week about, you know, neighbors were afraid of turning strangers into neighbors that Mike was speaking about, and had a little bit of an experience with it that I think begins to fit into all this. Can you tell us what happened briefly here?
Well, it's kind of that whole thing of taking the Sunday sermon and making Monday meaning. And so I'm walking my dog down by Lake Hiawatha, that's where we live, walking towards the beach there. And I see several people walking down towards the beach, and I have kind of a personal interest in the beach. Now I know it's tactical urbanism, I guess is the new thing, where I want to save the beach. The beach has been voted to be removed by the Minneapolis Park Board. And so I'm seeing these people go down there, and I'm looking at them, and it's like they're people I would not normally say hi to, and they get a put their blanket down on the beach, the family, and I said, okay, I'm going to go talk to them. Mike had a message. We met Ahmed from Somalia, and he talked and said, you know what, go and say hi, we're friendly and everything like that. So I go up to him and say, hi, what do you think about the beach? And, oh, I love the beach, and you know, it's going to be closed. Why? And it's like we got this bond of loving the beach, and we introduce each other, had some nice things to talk about. And I said, you know what, can I take your picture? I'm thinking, I don't know if they're going to like me taking a picture. Is that okay? And they were all cool and friendly and like, wow, this is so much more fun to like things and like people than to be scared or nervous about it. And so here's the family right here. And so that's cool.
And you're sending that picture on to Minneapolis Park and Rec?
You know, I think I'm going to start doing this. I did this again just yesterday. I was walking by, and there's a group of people, you know, playing the beach. And I said, talk to them about it. And they didn't know the beach was going to be closed. And I said, can I take your picture? I think I'm going to start doing this and just flood the park board with tons of pictures of people using the beach.
You know, they may have a compelling reason, and it might be the right thing to do, but I think it's really important that your voice is there, and they really reconsider.
They might have a reason, but it's not the right one. But
yeah, I'm with you. I'm trying to be diplomatic here.
Yeah, okay.
So you've been doing other experiments, though. I mean, this neighborliness thing is like you're actually doing something. We generally just talk about these things. We don't do them.
Right.
What else is going on?
Well, first, and I kind of jump a little bit, but
go ahead.
But you talked about having stories with places. And, you know, my uncle was a lifeguard at this beach back in the 1940s. My aunt dragged my mom down to the beach every day to meet him because they wanted to, you know, she wanted to be hanging around this lifeguard. And so they were married for 50 years. And so, yeah, it's interesting when I hear that a place is having a story. Mm-hmm. And so the whole thing about single story, getting to know places, brings it to life. So anyways, but as far as another thing with neighborliness, we had a situation where I had to tear our chimney down. It was leaking, and so we lost the typical landscaping in front of our little house with the big arborvitae. And the next year, I was thinking, what can I do with this space? And we decided to turn it into a front yard patio, gathering place, seating area, little fire pit, which...
There's a picture right there.
There it is. And it was interesting doing that, because some people would walk by and say, oh, that's really cool. And other people would walk by and say, you know, why would you put money in the front of the house? Why put it in the back of the house where you can have your privacy? And that was not the point. The point was to see people and to say hi to people and to try to, it's more like a social experiment, to see what would happen with the neighborhood. Would other people start doing something with their front yards? And actually, a next-door neighbor did something with his front yard, and a couple people down put another bench out in their front afterwards. And it is a great place to sit. I have a whole other room, and it's a social room. Sometimes awkward when you're seeing people like, I don't know you, but I'm working on it.
And what you said, someone moved in and commented on.
Thank you. Yeah, we had a neighbor that moved in about a year ago, and she came up and talked to me and said, you know what, when I saw that front patio area, it made me think that these people are friendly in this block, and they that was one of the main reasons they bought the house that they did down the street.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
great. Thank you.
So,
did you have a question?
I was going to comment to him back. Oh. So can you go to slide number 12 of mine? I was going to tell you what you did without you knowing. Is you created a thing called a threshold. And this is something that I would encourage all of you all to think about. So it's this connection between the indoor and outdoor, the private and public realm. And it actually invites people to converse with you more. And it's so funny because if you look at that top left picture, you see there's a porch and there's also a gate and a chain link fence. And a lot of people think that the fence automatically is kind of like a stay away. And it actually encourages more conversation because it clearly demarcates what is private and what is public. And so people in the private realm feel more freedom to go all the way up to the edge because they know what the boundary is. And same with people in the public realm. And so you actually find that more conversations happen over a fence like that than without one. So good job. You created a threshold.
I actually have a really good follow-up question for that. That made me think of Mr. Wilson, by the way, from Home Improvement.
That's awesome.
I was wondering how in Minnesota we might maintain, or we might use the built environment to maintain that neighborliness in the wintertime.
I get asked this a lot, and I always say...
I'm from Texas. How would I know?
I know. Well, I just hibernate. What do you... y'all do stuff in the winter?
Y'all.
Yeah. No, what I say is go to the neighborhood bar or go to the neighborhood coffee shop, because really that's what happens in Minnesota in the winter, is those community spaces become much more the place to engage. I know that it's tricky with walkability and things here, but there are people who do it all winter long too. But I would just encourage you to find that what we call the third place in your neighborhood and really be an active participant there.
What are the first and second places?
Well, let's work, home, and then your third place.
Okay.
Or homework. It probably should be homework.
Homework or homeschool or whatever it would be. Okay. That's good. Shovel your neighbor's sidewalk.
Yes. Yes. Shovel your own, too.
Yeah.
I've been on some pretty treacherous walks.
So what are some things we talked about? You know, there's points of action. One of the things that you can do, and this is on your line, is maybe the first thing to do is to take a neighborhood walk. Mm-hmm. All right? Which means, and this is a great thing, if you're in group life, in fact, we're going to encourage you as your group life group, wherever you're meeting, go do a neighborhood walk. Otherwise, just do it with your spouse, partner, some friends. One of the things that might really be interesting is what Eddie was talking about earlier, is take a neighborhood walk with someone who is very different than you because of abilities or because of cultural background or something. They're seeing different stuff than you are. Go on a neighborhood walk and talk about what do you see. And if you wonder, well, what is a neighborhood walk? If you go, I think this is on the bottom of the Sunday paper. It might be up there too, but yeah. If you go to jacobswell.net/walk, there's a guide to things to think about when you're doing a neighborhood walk that Sarah Joy put together, and you can find that guide there. You can pull it up on your smartphone right now. But there's things we can look about and things that we can do to impact our home, our neighborhood, our city, and that really are important. We've just got a couple of minutes, but there's something you want to say about that.
Okay. doing what he did here, as far as putting something in your front yard, I just really encourage people to inhabit public space, to sit in your front yard. I mean, if it means putting a lawn chair out front, or whatever it be, play with your kids in the front yard. So often people play with their kids in the backyard. And so I encourage that. Going to the neighborhood association, being an active member is really, really important. I also think, you know, supporting local businesses as much as you can. I know that, you know, a lot of times going to the small local co-op is more costly than going to Super Target for groceries and things like that. And so I recognize that there are barriers there, you know, with things like that. But where you can support local business, I really encourage you to do that. So if it's like, hey, I'll purchase my eggs at the co-op, but I'll buy some, you know, but transitioning with some of that, of really showing support for the local business, is really important. I think too, one thing that is really underutilized are bus stops. They're one of the most underutilized public spaces in a neighborhood, and there's like creative ways that you can do various things with bus stops. So just think creatively, think iteratively too. It doesn't need to be that, you know, you go out and sit out in a lawn chair and like nobody comes by and it doesn't work. So, okay. You know, I mean, so go do it somewhere else. Put your chair somewhere else and sit in it. I mean, just figure it out. See what draws, you know, interaction and what works. And not everything's going to work every time, but you'll figure it out. I mean, we're human beings. We understand community. We were made for it, so.
Yeah, we're good. And it's fun. And, you know, those things that seem impossible or scary, you find when you do it that, wow, that not only worked, but it was easy and fun. And the other person was hoping you would talk to them.
Yeah, that's the funny thing. Is like, when you get neighbors actually talking, they're like, oh, yeah, we, like, really don't like that aspect down the street. And we really like that one, too. And you actually, like, have a lot of agreement about your environment, but nobody really knows necessarily what to do or how to address it. But the first thing is just to start having those conversations and then start thinking, okay, how can we address this together? Because together, it's a lot easier, right, than just you on your own, the Lone Ranger, doing it.
So if some of us have some ideas and questions, maybe we meet with our group life group or our block, you know, club, block group or something like that. Can we get in touch with you about questions?
And please, that'd be okay. Do. I love talking about
two things that I know I'm going to be following up with you on personally. Is one is the parklet thing. Yeah, you're going to hear more from me on that. The other is, like, we're almost a dead-end street where our house is, but still cars, because, you know, people leaving for zip down it at 35 right. miles an hour, even though they only had one block to speed up. And this idea of painting, like, putting paintings on the street, slow mm-hmm. cars down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a very common tactical urbanism thing. It's called paint the pavement. And people will bring out neighbors for, like, a community development afternoon project or so, and you paint a big mural on the street. And it actually slows traffic down because people, as they're driving, they see something on the street and they don't know what it is. They slow down. They're kind of intrigued by it, and it actually creates a safer street. So it's a very common thing.
Good.
Also, I would love to, if you'd go to my very last slide, it has some resources on it.
Oh, I'm not sure it's on there, actually.
Oh, you cut it out?
Oh, no, there it is. Sorry.
So here are just some websites and books and films that touch on these issues that I think are very helpful. And they're a good way to get introduced if you're like, oh, this is really fascinating, I want to know more. These are some places to go to find out more information.
Amanda, I think we probably did not take too many of your questions.
No, but I'm just writing all mine.
Okay. So we'll post these and try to get some responses to you on it. These conversations could go on for hours, and we've already more than used our time up. So let me just close with this thought, in that we really are, we're called to be neighbors, and not just inconvenience, but to stop and care for this person, even though it takes us off our path, and to care for them, to provide for them. And, you know, that's good. That means that there's a neighbor who's going to care for us, too. So being neighbors is a very mutual sort of thing. And it's, you know, who's it going to start with? It's going to start with us. Why not? Let's let it start with us. And be inventive. Find ways to do it at home. Find ways to do it with your neighborhood. Find ways to do it with the macro scale of city, state, and as well. And, you know, find your niche on that process. And let's support each other in doing that. Would you join me in a prayer? God. That you saw us as neighbors. Maybe you thought you were too far off in heaven and we're here on earth. It's a figurative way of thinking about it, but nonetheless, you said, no, I'm going to be a neighbor. I'm going to get born there. I'm going to live in the hood, and I'm going to grow up, and I'm going to feel it, and I'm going to know what it means to pull people together and to know one another and to be one. That was a pretty daunting example for us. Help us in our own ways to live that out, to live into that, and to be neighbors in a way that just show that we love each other just like we love ourselves, and that we know that that is the way that you made this world to work. Help us to be in that. It's not as easy as we make it sound right now. Some of these, there's some real problems. There are some reasons for giving up. There's some seems like hopeless situations. Help us to be creative. Help us to work together and strengthen each other and to find ways around what seems to be dead ends. Most of all, just be with us as we are neighbors with one another. In your name we pray. Amen. Well, thank you, Sarah Joy. Thank you, Amanda. And there are some, yeah, let's give them a hand. You can be in touch with Sarah Joy via the Proximity Project or through me, too. There are some offering baskets. I think they're on this, on the two ends, my right, your left. And so if you can put your communication cards there and your gifts. If Jacob's Well is a new place for you, your presence is your gift. But if this is your home, I don't know. Our ministry, I think, really makes a difference. And this is how it happens, through your financial gifts as well as all the other ways you make us happen. So thank you for your generosity. And I like the percussion. That's good. And we got
Justin was kicking us off there. I was like, I don't think we're quite ready.
We got boom, 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 boom. So that was his daughter. So the last song particularly was like just such a obvious home run song. I can't wait to hear it. So we got two songs. Mm-hmm. Play them. I'll get out of your way.
Yeah, and.